When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
To listen without ads, head over to patreon.com/rightandwrong.
Ooh, a spicy question. I love it.
Because the writing is sort of everything, right? Like, you kind of can fix plot holes, but if the writing is
so some readers love that, and some readers are like, but I wanted more of this. So it's kind of a gamble.
Hello, and welcome back to the Right and Wrong podcast. On this episode, I'm joined by a returning guest, a literary agent who represents a range of writing from children's all the way up through YA and into adult. It's Megan Carroll. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's jump right in to tackle one of the big issues, the tough questions, one of the hottest topics. What does crossover mean?
What does crossover mean? That's a great question. And I think the problem is that no one really knows the answer.
That's what I'm gathering.
So it used to be that it's usually YA fantasy that was predominantly crossover.
Okay.
And I think it used to just be that people were realizing that YA was read by adults and they wanted to kind of tap into that and not alienate those readers and buyers by leaning further into the adult themes to kind of capture even more of that readership. And so it sort of crosses over into adult in that sense. But what it does do is to sort of muddy the waters of YA and adult in a way that is quite difficult for particularly querying authors. But also kind of, you know, down to sort of booksellers. You know, there's no crossover section of the bookshop.
Yeah.
There's YA and then there's adult. So it's a sort of difficult situation of placement and where you put those types of books and who they're exactly for as well. All of these questions are quite difficult elements of it.
So by that description, and as someone who reads a lot of fantasy, I'm thinking of things like The Name of the Wind, or like a lot of Brandon Sanderson and stuff, where there are teenage protagonists, but it's like, I wouldn't call it YA, but at the same time, I don't know if I would call it like, but it would be suitable for YA, but it's also kind of adult. That's kind of the area you're talking about.
Yeah, it kind of has that. It has the essence of YA, the world building or the characters, as you say, you know, the ethos and the feeling of YA, but it sort of creeps into those more adult themes. And sometimes that can be through, you know, what the level of danger that happens, the level of like peril and issue that they face, or it can be on a romance level too.
Right. Okay. So why is it now? Why is it? It sounds like it used to be a kind of more niche thing sort of tucked away and there was just a few books that kind of fell into this category. Why is it now all of a sudden everything that everyone's talking about all the time?
I think it's because of book talk. Predominantly it's because of book talk. I mean, YA readers were always a mixture of adults and young adults and teens. That's always been the case. I mean, that's not the people that read it haven't really changed. It's just that now it's a bit more obvious.
Right. Okay.
Now it's a bit more obvious that adult readers are there and they're a huge portion of that market.
Okay. So is it the same thing as new adult?
No, it's not. So new adult is a new term. And it's mostly come from the States.
Right.
And so not used nearly as frequently in the UK as it is over there. And it used to predominantly mean that kind of space for the protagonist that was in between being an adult and being a teenager. So the protagonists themselves are kind of 18 to early 20s.
Okay.
It's that kind of university. They're just kind of breaking out into the adult world kind of area. So all of the topics tended to be quite focused on going to university, you know, first job, first house, first relationship, all of those types of milestones. But with a higher kind of spice level, if it's a romance, a higher kind of danger level, if it's fantasy. I mean, new adult doesn't really encroach into lots of genres. It tends to be, at least from what I see, it tends to just be romance or fantasy, romanticy. It's, you know, there's not new adult crime, for example, or I haven't seen any, if there is.
Yeah, because a lot of crime as a genre leans towards having a sort of grizzled detective or like a world-weary character as your kind of protagonist who's solving the crimes.
Yeah, nobody wants to read like a brand new detective. Maybe they do, actually. Maybe that would be adding something new to the genre.
Yeah. They'd have to have something. But if you do that, then obviously you have to have something different about, like, they'd have to be a super genius or something, or have some other quirk that kind of set them aside from some other young
and
detective.
And I think because of the readership of that genre, it would never need to be new adult anyway. It would just be a young protagonist. That's the kind of thing that's the real problem with crossover, new adult, and where to put your book. If you're a querying author or if you're an agent and you're sending something out, is there's so many different factors can mean so many different things. You know, you can have an adult book with a young protagonist. That's obviously true. There's loads of examples of that, but it's very rare to have a teen or a YA book with only adult protagonists. That wouldn't work.
Right. Okay. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense.
So you kind of have to figure out within the parameters of the book where, you know, what is more important, what element is more important, and where it has to sit because of those things.
Okay. Is that something that, obviously, this is now something that publishers are asking for quite a lot, is when you have an author and you're looking to take something on submission, start sending it to editors, do you guys sit down and say, right, we need to figure out exactly where this is going, how we're pitching it, and then we're going to draw out, say, you know, we want this to be YA, so we're actually going to emphasize more the YA stuff and dial back on anything that could make it lean into crossover, or vice versa. It's like, oh, we want this to be in crossover, so we're going to kind of pull out more of these elements to make it more fit into that space.
Yeah, definitely. That's definitely a conversation that you have, because you'll have, from YA crossover to new adult, you'll have different, you know, word length parameters. You'll have different things that you can and cannot do within those age ranges. And also there's a case for, you know, if it's a series and that series wants to mature and develop, you might think, okay, maybe this would be a better place to be on a crossover list, because the second it starts to get more mature, it's going to be a whole different readership. You know, like Sarah J. Maas back in the day was published as YA, but you could never publish that now. And, you know, the way that her books have matured in themes and in content has meant that the YA, particularly in foreign territories, the YA publishers that bought those books at the beginning now can't publish them on their YA lists. So you kind of have to think long term about where you want that book to go, where that author wants that series to go. But yeah, YA, you'll have to, you know, you have to strategically age down. You'll have to think about how long is it? Is it working for just the UK and the US YA market? Or do we also want it to work for, you know, the YA markets in translation? You know, is that a concern?
Yeah. Okay. Okay. And there's, and speaking of Sarah J. Maas, I think there's a lot of, from what I've seen, there seems to be a lot of connection with these two genres and spice.
Indeed.
Explicit romantic scenes. But from what your description here, it doesn't sound like that's it has to be there. Like, it's something that's often there and it's become very popular. I think a lot of the book talk stuff is very romantically explicit, let's say. But from your kind of descriptions, it's actually not necessarily a core part of that. They're not really genres, but that kind of age range.
No, not necessarily. I mean, the new adult stuff tends to be steamy.
Okay.
It always tends to lean that way. And that might change, but it's often that. And I mean, the thing that's happening is that those are the books that are popular. That's what the readers at the moment are wanting. They're wanting steamy. So publishers are leaning into that and ensuring that that's what they're delivering.
Okay.
So it's, with YA, obviously, no steam. You can't be at all steamy in YA because that would be insane. you're marketing a book for teenagers. But the problem with book talk, with this kind of mess of YA crossover new adult, is that what is becoming difficult for the buyers, you know, parents, but also actual teenagers buying their YA books, is that they're all kind of being published in the same way. And so it's really hard to differentiate between what is an appropriate book and what's a really inappropriate book for that reader.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Sarah J. Maas's huge book talk sensation, you know, but those books came out ages ago. But people that are young are seeing those books and wanting to read them themselves. And obviously they're incredibly inappropriate for some people on the younger end of that YA spectrum.
Yeah.
But they're being published in the same way as like any other YA fantasy or any other crossover fantasy. So it's hard when you're out of the industry to differentiate between what do I want my teenager to read and what do I not want them to read.
Yeah, exactly. Because I guess YA, would you say YA kind of broadly covers a sort of from like 14 to 18 maybe?
Yeah, which I mean has its own problems because 14-year-olds and 18-year-olds are often very different.
Yeah.
But yeah, if you're thinking middle grade is covering kind of 8 to 12, maybe up to 13, mm-hmm. you've kind of got that teen, which some publishers, you know, consciously publish into, some don't, which is kind of 12 to 14, let's say. And then YA is, yeah, above that, 14 or 15 above. So you've got a lot of different parameters within that age group, a lot of different levels of what is and isn't appropriate for a 15-year-old, a 14-year-old, and then, you know, the top end, 18, 19.
Yeah.
It's hard to publish one book that suits all of those readers.
Yeah, for sure. And now, especially with these kind of lines being blurred between YA through to adult, it's, I guess, even harder.
Exactly. Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I had Chloe Seeger on recently and was chatting with her about this same thing. And I thought it was an interesting question from like a agent's point of view, is that she is coming at it from YA is the top of what she represents. She represents children's books. So she's been kind of excited about it because it's opening up a whole range of editors and publishers who had previously not been accessible to her because they didn't take YA, as in they just took adult, but they've now kind of opened up to crossover and new adult stuff. As someone who represents adult and YA stuff, have you found that there's sort of new openings available to you, new opportunities?
It definitely has opened the pool of editors that you can send, you know, that top end YA crossover to, and that's no bad thing. But it is, once you open that pool and you're sending it to adult publishers, you are kind of pushing the book in one way. And that mm-hmm. is a choice that you're making, you and the author. The thing with adult publishers as well is that they probably have more money. You know, there's going to be higher advances from those places, potentially, you know, not always. And I think more opportunities for the authors in terms of more editors being able to look at their book has got to be a positive. It's just ensuring that, you know, if an author comes to me really wanting to write YA and that be their passion, you know, you don't want them to alienate, you know, actual YA readers by sort of pushing themselves too far the other way, because that's the new hot thing that's happening. But yeah, I think there are a lot of positives to editors looking at YA and considering that and making that part of their list. And it makes, you know, hopefully all the publishers a little bit more competitive in terms of what they're needing to do now to acquire the best YA that's coming through.
Yeah.
For me, obviously, I'm seeing those editors anyway. So it's not been that it's opening up loads of different editors I've not been in touch with, but it's widening the pool mm-hmm. of places okay. I can submit to, which is good.
Yeah. So as in on an individual level for like per author, per kind of manuscript that you're looking to put out, there's now more kind of spaces that you could send it to. There's more.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Okay. That's interesting.
But what I think you get into when you're doing that, is that an adult publisher might be able to put more money down and some children's publishers won't be able to compete, but then you have to decide, okay, whose hands would this book be best published in? You know, mm-hmm. who's going to do it in the best way? But those conversations that you always have when you're sending out a book and you're always thinking, okay, whose hands are the best hands for this?
Yeah. And I imagine it's a lot to do with the brand that the author wants to set up, because the author looking ahead to their career is, if you commit to writing something that you at one point maybe had some YA influence and now you've signed with an adult publisher and you're kind of, everything will age slightly up, the editor will probably age things up a bit, that's, you're probably then going to be expected to follow that with sequels or whatever the next book will be also in that same kind of age range.
Yeah, exactly.
Interesting. Let's talk a bit about you, focus more on that. You joined Watson Little in 2014, mm-hmm. 10 years ago, decade.
Yep, nearly 10 years ago.
Over that time, have you noticed any sort of big shifts or changes to do with being an agent or publishing as a whole?
Save big on your Memorial Day barbecue, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound rolls of juicy 80% lean ground beef for $3.49 a pound with a digital coupon. Then get select varieties of flavorful Powerade, Body Armor Super Drink, or Arizona Tea for 77 cents each, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The shifts in being an agent, I think we're across much more now. I think the scope of what you represent is much wider. You know, we have authors that do podcasts. We have people that are, you know, talking heads on TV. We have mm-hmm. people that do, you know, loads of speaking events through the year, and that's a huge part of their brand. It's not just about here's the book, sell the book. It's much more kind of full service what we do now, and which I think is fun and exciting. You know, you're getting to sort of dip your toe into lots of other elements of the business as a whole. It feels much more expansive than it did when I started. It was changing before then, but it feels, you know, there's so many different elements of what you can help your clients with now. It feels wide.
That's interesting. So you're almost sort of, the term literary agent, you're sort of almost sort of changing literary in that you are becoming more, like you say, full service agents.
Yeah, definitely. For some, and there are still situations where, you know, clients have a speaking talent manager or whatever it is, but there are uh-huh. often times where we're dealing with things that are not books. But that's quite exciting. I've always liked that element of things changing.
That's, I guess it's true also of authors, because nowadays, if you're an author, you know, there's a lot of promotion and marketing, which rests on your shoulders. And then authors also will do a lot of things outside of just writing the books to sort of promote their books, but also like promote other sides of them, promote them as a kind of, as an author, as a brand, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. It has really changed. You know, it used to be, and you still can do this. It used to be that you could just have your book come out and, you know, that was it. You kind of could disappear if you so wanted to. But there are people that don't do that, and they kind of want to be very present and very online, and they'll, mm-hmm. you know, be the guests on podcasts, or they'll do their own, or they'll want to do events in schools if they're children's author, or they'll want to do, you know, festivals. And there is a degree of that being sorted out by publishers or by, you know, other agencies or other management. But we also are finding that we're doing that here as well, more often than not.
Okay, that's so cool. Because I guess it makes, if you can get, if you as an author or just any creator, I guess generally, if you can have one agent that covers all of the facets of what you want to do creatively, it's better than having multiple agents. Then you're just adding more meetings and conversations to the whole mixture.
Yeah, exactly. Streamlines the whole thing, doesn't it?
Exactly. Perfect. Watson Little taking over the world. and so on from that, looking ahead, are there any kind of things which are sort of coming into to manifest now? Any kind of predictions or directions the industry looks like it's heading?
I'm not sure. I mean, the AI stuff is there, sort mm-hmm. of lingering in the shadows in a way that is hard to predict what it will
less
be.
Less and less in the shadows with every passing day.
Really coming out the shadows. And it's going to be interesting to see how that changes, mm-hmm. particularly illustrators, but also authors and you know, maybe celebrity talent.
I've heard translation has already been largely affected by it.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I mean, I've had conversations with our rights director, Rachel, here about that kind of thing. But yeah, it's, and on the one hand, you think there's an element of, you know, saving time, being more efficient, all of those things mm-hmm. seem exciting, but they seem quite far away from what we're doing, which is, you know, books, writing books, hopefully, but that people have written themselves.
Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. But it's hard to predict what will happen with that. I mean, everyone thought ebooks would just sort of disappear, and that obviously didn't quite go that way.
Well, that ebooks are bigger than ever.
Still, exactly.
Yeah. And I've heard audiobooks are also bigger than ever.
Audiobooks are, yeah. They were having a real time during the pandemic, I think, because people were just had a lot of more downtime, I suppose, a lot more free time.
And also were out of the office, I guess.
Yeah. I didn't listen to much more on the audiobook side, but podcasts, I really did. So yeah. I think I get that kind of need and want for, like, I suppose maybe it was just listening to someone else speak that wasn't in your immediate family.
Yeah. I was listening to Brandon Sanderson does a lot of YouTube videos and things like that. And he was talking about, and one of them, he was talking about how he'd noticed with his book specifically and in fantasy, the number of people listening on audiobook was starting to become almost the most kind of, I don't know how to phrase this. More people were listening on audiobook in some cases than were actually like buying the physical book. Some of his things. And I think in fantasy, audiobooks has become a huge part of how people experience those stories.
Oh, definitely. I think it's becoming such a dominating format when it used to just not be at all. Mm-hmm. And now it's a really huge part of an author's sales. Genres than other genres, of course, but you know, I don't know what will happen with children's audio, whether that will continue to grow in the same way. I suppose with the lengths of them, it's a bit more difficult to predict how to get that bit to boom.
And I think it's a lifestyle thing too. A lot of I know a lot of people who, when they go to the gym or if they go for a run or if they're like doing gardening or something, they'll have either an audiobook or a podcast on.
Yeah. My colleague is like that. She goes for runs with sort of War and Peace in her head, or whatever it is she's listening to at the time.
It's a long run. Awesome. But that's really interesting. I guess we all have to kind of just wait and see what happens with AI. And it's not just in publishing, it's across the world. I think it's from what I've heard, and translation's a good way of kind of looking at this. It's sort of like you touched on, there's going to be upside to a lot of it where you think, oh, well, it's great that translation will be quicker and easily accessible so that we can translate more books so that more people can access books from written in different languages. Mm-hmm. But then on the other hand, there's the problem of it's like, well, you know, all these translators are now going to have a much harder time finding work or things like that. So I think a lot of it's going to come with good, but also bad. And it's going to be about treading that line.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's, as with any change, any big change, there's going to be things that are great and there's going to be things that aren't so good. And we'll just have to keep an eye on what those things are and make sure they don't get too bad.
Yeah. We just have to wait for the dust to settle. I've heard and I assume you're doing this at Watson Little as well, but I've heard the contracts of, a lot more has to be added into contracts now to protect the authors and the writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the publishers too, they're also kind of trying to protect themselves from books written entirely by AI.
Yeah.
Although I think you can spot a book written entirely by AI at the moment.
Maybe
it will become more sophisticated in a year's time.
Yeah.
But I can still, I think, touch wood, spot an AI book.
Have you had some submissions where you've been like, this is AI?
Not so much actual sort of queries as in the sum of chapters, but the query letters, we have had a few submission letters that definitely feel like they were constructed by AI.
I've heard it's a big issue in job applications.
Yes, we were hiring recently and I'm quite certain that at least one of the cover letters it's just sort of in that strange, sort of uncanny way they refer to mm-hmm. the business or refer to what we do.
Yeah.
In a way that was really weird to read. And I thought, we all thought, wait, is this, I'm pretty sure that this is done via AI.
Yeah. Oh, it's weird. It's a scary, scary new world. Let's get back onto less scary things. Let's talk about your list and taking on new authors. We chatted about this last time you were on the podcast. So for anyone listening, if you want to hear more about Megan's secret ways of going through submissions, things like that, go back, check out number 64. We might be retreading some things, but it's been a long time. So
it has. Maybe I'll do everything differently now.
Yeah, exactly. To kick off, do you know how many authors you represent right now?
Oh, a lot.
Ah, yes, a lot.
I would say, it's probably around 40 or something.
I don't know when the website was last updated, but I think there's on the website, there's 40 on your page.
Oh, so it's probably more than that because there would be a few things that I represent, like estates, for the agency and stuff like that. But yeah, so around maybe 50 then, let's conservatively say around 50.
Okay. So it's, as you say, a lot. As your list grows, do you find yourself signing new authors with less frequency?
There is definitely sort of more caution because you're aware of how much time that you have. But I have recently hired an assistant.
Oh.
And so she, I love her. I love her so much. She's so great. She, because she's so sort of eager and she's reading at such speed, I have in the past few months actually taken on more than I probably would if she wasn't here. I just suppose that is the mark of a good assistant. But you're always a bit cautious because there's things that I love in submissions and I just think, I just don't have the time for this right now. And I feel it wouldn't be right to take you on and make you wait where another agent won't do that. So yeah, it is, you do sort of slow down on taking on new things, but then there'll be periods where you'll sort of realize all of your authors are quite engaged in something or in contracts. And there's a bit of a lull where you think, I've got a bit of space. I could find something here. I could take something on now.
Okay. Yeah.
Because the need and want to take things on doesn't go anywhere. I still want to take on loads of things.
Yeah.
But you have to, I can't do it all.
In that first instance, if you do come across something and you think, I wish I could take this, but I just don't have the bandwidth for it right now. Do you sometimes in that instance, maybe pass that on to someone else at Watson Little?
If I think it could appeal, I would. But maybe then I'd be too jealous to see it really closely near me, but not mine. Yeah. So maybe then it's better if it's gone completely out of my reach.
Okay. It's good you know yourself that well.
Yeah. I had a situation quite recently where I really, really loved a book. I thought it was so great, but I just did not. I just looked at the queue of things that I had to read, you know, all of the manuscripts I'd had delivered by clients, all of the fulls that I already had. And I just think I can't, and they had another offer. So it was just, I reluctantly stepped back, but I'm still sort of quite annoyed about it. And I keep checking to see who they've signed with on their social media so that I can be even more obsessed with it, I suppose. But you have that sort of sense of regret, but I can buy that book now as a fan when that book comes out and I can be supportive of that. I wish I'd had the time, but I just don't. You've got to know your own limitations, I suppose, when it comes to these things.
Yeah, of course, because like you said, it's not good for the author or that book if you sign them and then you're like, okay, this is great. But the thing is, I have about 6 months of backlog before I can even sit down with you and like have a conversation. That's not good for any, no one really wins there.
No, it's just not very good agenting. It's bad.
Yeah. And that's the truth about it. That's a good little bit of information there for people to consider querying and things like that. Is it's like there's sometimes where the stars don't align. It's not the right time and it's not the right place. But like, it doesn't mean that you didn't love the story or the manuscript.
Yeah, absolutely.
You represent authors and stories from middle grade. Actually, do you rep picture books?
I do sometimes. Yeah, I do off the off one or two. Yeah,
but seen on the website, which now I'm not sure when it was last updated because you only have 40 people on the website. You're not currently taking submissions for picture books though, is that right?
No, that is still true. So I do picture books when one of my authors decides to send me a picture book text.
Okay.
And they're like, right, I've done this. And I think, oh, lovely. And I love doing that. Okay. But I would rather have authors that do older texts as well as picture books, not just picture books, solo.
Gotcha. So, okay. So it's, so you do rep picture books up through middle grade, so, through YA to adult, but you don't take subs for picture books.
Exactly. Exactly right.
Okay. And is your list evenly spread kind of across those age groups?
Relatively. I think there's probably a bit more adult on there at the moment.
Okay.
We, almost a year ago now, we acquired an agency called the Juliet Burton Literary Agency.
Okay.
And Juliet's list was all adult authors. So those have been redistributed through the agents here. And so now I think that's tipped me more adult than non-adult. So now I have to tip it back. Now I have space to get some children's stuff.
Okay. Is that genuinely like you would like to get some more kind of younger stuff to kind of level things out again? Or are you just joking?
I liked, well, partially, it's a bit of both. I like to, the reason my list is so hugely broad, which it can be difficult to manage sometimes, but I quite like being able to kind of leave the adult and move to children and just do something completely, read something completely different. And not that it's using a hugely different part of my brain, but it just feels like enough of a switch.
Yeah.
That it sort of re-energizes you as you're moving through very, very different books. I find if I have to read the same type of book too frequently, I'll lose steam on that. So I quite like to sort of jump around and do like a children's nonfiction here and middle grade and then over to a rom-com and then over to, you know, a nonfiction memoir for adults or whatever it is.
Yeah, that makes sense. And then you keep your energy high whenever you move on to the next project because it's something
new.
Yeah. Is it quite a different sort of system or approach when you're putting out a children's or YA manuscript versus an adult one?
In terms of the logistics, not really.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of format and this, you're thinking about the same types of things. It's just that children's publishing is perhaps a bit slower than adult publishing. Not always.
Okay.
But it can be.
Yeah. I've heard like things like announcements and stuff are generally held off a lot more, get them closer to festivals and things for children's.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. But logistically in terms of, you know, what you need, what you're sending out, how you're approaching sending out is pretty much the same.
Yeah. Which I guess is the same as, writers submitting to agents, children's, logistically, it's a very similar thing. Obviously, the content is the big changing thing there.
Definitely.
Awesome. That brings us to The Desert Island, which, now last time you were on, whilst expressing how much you disliked the question, you said you'd have a different answer every day if you were asked it. So last time your choice was Emma, Jane Austen.
Oh, I do love that book.
Would that be your choice today?
I don't know. I don't... probably not.
No?
No, I think I should stand by how I'll have a different one every day.
Is it going to be a different Austen?
I do love Jane Austen. I do, for my sins. I mean, she's great. She's the best.
Satirical
novelist of that time. She's so good. I could reread those books all the time, every day, forever.
And she did all the fantasy, all the romance tropes.
She did, and she did beautifully. She did them so well, to the point where now we still get submissions that are, you know, this is a spin on Pride and Prejudice, or this is a spin on Sense and Sensibility. And I think, great. I know that it's going to be great then. Brilliant. Well, if it's a good spin. I think the one I would take this time, and this is a children's book, so it's totally different.
Okay.
And I might have said this before, is Vinegar Street by Philip Ridley, which is my favourite children's book ever.
Oh, okay.
And we were in Bologna last week. So I was just, my mind was very children's books. And I think about this book all the time. I love it so much. It's so weird. Oh, really? It's the weirdest book. It's quirky, if you had to sort of use a descriptor.
Yeah.
But it's so great. I could read it every day, I think.
Yeah, there's definitely something to be said about a book that you think about all the time, or just every now and again, you're like, that book, you can tell that book affected you in a way, you know?
Yeah, I really, yeah. I'd love to find something like it, but I actually think that it wouldn't even be published today. It's just so odd that I just don't know who would take a chance on it. I think because Philip Ridley had obviously such a good publishing credentials.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great book.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm glad you picked something new and it wasn't just another Austin. It's always exciting to hear.
Next time I'll pick another Austin. I'll go back to Austin.
Okay. Yeah, a nice eclectic jump to something different there, just like your list.
Indeed.
Awesome. So my next questions are all about different parts of Megan's list, what she's looking to pick up, the idea of concept as king and weird DMs as an agent. But we are at the end of the regular episode and into the extended cut exclusive to Patreon subscribers. So anyone listening who hasn't yet joined the Patreon, please do think about it. It goes a long way towards covering the cost of running this podcast. As I said, you have a great understanding of yourself, Megan. You know your limitations there.
I do. I'm happy to read them. I'll read novels forever. No writing for me.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Megan, for coming on the podcast and telling us all about what you've been up to, what's going on in publishing and what you're looking for and all that cool stuff. It's been awesome chatting with you.
Pleasure. It's been so nice chatting to you too.
And for anyone wanting to keep up with Megan, you can find her on Twitter at Megan A. Carroll. That's two R's and two L's. And to support the podcast, like, follow and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice and follow along on all socials. Join the Patreon for extended episodes ad-free and a week early and check out my other podcasts, The Chosen Ones and Other Ropes. Thanks again, Megan, and thanks to everyone listening. We'll catch you on the next episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.